this thing might be bigger than even we think it is.
Do you need an upgrade to the soundtrack to your life? Perhaps a song from a film or a tune from TV? My name is Gap. Exploding Head Movies is here to give you sounds from the cinema, along with the songs that will be defining your future, and those forgotten classics that need a little rescue. Loading Head Movies, Monday, 7 to 9 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hey, it's Cynthia from The Bike Kitchen. We moved, but we are still nearby. The Bike Kitchen is now located on East Mall in the trailer between Irving, Cape Barber, and Brock Hall. Come down and check out our selection of used bikes. Work on your bike with our tools or get a tune-up by one of our pro mechanics. We have a 1 or 2 day turnaround on all tune-ups. Check out our website, thebikekitchen.com, for more information about our services and prices.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam Nisiyaya, think I'm Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyam Nisiyaya, and the Skakuya, Tilitin, who must we must stay out.
Good evening, and welcome to another African Rhythms. Start out with this African Rhythms Radio in the summer, in late June 2017. I'm David Love Jones, and we have back Mike Ingram from Philly and Jason Hoover. Welcome back, guys.
Yes, indeed. Good evening, everybody. Nice. Happy Canada Day weekend and all that good stuff. Good to be back in BC.
Long weekend.
Canada's birthday. Canada's birthday, as well as our brother down to the south. And that's a big, big country. But our country's bigger. They just have more people.
A lot more people.
Huge amount more people.
Yeah.
You know, I always thought, you know, if they ever really figured out and it's come up here some summer and say, well, where's the peoples, man? It'd blow a lot of people's mind. We have nearly 25 million people in Canada. That's a very little amount. You're talking, you can't even put any parts of all the people in New York State. There's more people there than in all of Canada.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we were talking about some of Jason Hoover's history and how he came from Edmonton and how he grew up in the R&B soul scene in the 60s and into the mid-70s making a soul funk album. So we're going to cover another aspect of that a little bit later in the show. But next, we're going to play what is your musical relationship like with a gentleman named Donny Hathaway?
Oh, man, he was my love, man. I mean, I think everybody that did R&B fell deeply in love with Donny Hathaway because he was so unique. And until this day, there's been nobody that can replace his beingness. And that's the word I have to use, is beingness. I mean, there's a lot of singers that can sing just as well. It was his beingness. It was Donny's beingness.
A gifted genius.
Yeah, he was genius. He was definitely, I don't even want to go there because I don't understand genius. I know that it makes you special. But with Donny Hathaway, he was more than special. He was, what could I call it? I wouldn't go as far as saying total genius on a street genius. Donny Hathaway, to this day, still has his unique sound, but he had something else, too. I think it has to do a lot, David, with his phrasing.
Yes.
I think his phrasing of the song.
For sure. Well, let's check him out now.
It is obvious to you that at that time our love is through. Even though we love each other in a special way, I couldn't give you everything you wanted me to give. But here you are with the ring on your finger saying that you still love me, when really it's not right for us to be together. And I still love you. So take me now and let me love you. That's all I really want to do. 'Cause after time is over, I know you'll be going back to him. Speak easy and release yourself. Speak easy. We'll always have the memory of our All right.
Wow, what a groove. Donny Hathaway on African Rhythms. Huh. And you can hear, Mike, right at the end there, how it just merely is just a one-take studio thing. You know, yeah. Like that's not been, there's no overdubs and things added. It could have been if it had ever come out.
I, you know, that's the, and that's the kind of thing that probably drives record labels crazy, because A&R people, their job is to make sure that the talent is pushed forward the best way possible. You know, in that time frame in the 70s, you had funk, you had fusion, and all this other stuff was going on, and you had real singers and real performers. Very often, the people that were hired to do these jobs and take care of this talent, I won't say they didn't know what they were talking about, but they didn't really appreciate what they talked about. Jason was saying earlier about the phrasing, you know, you didn't hear that in anybody, and they, the first thing they'll say is, it's not commercial enough. And when they say it's not commercial enough, that's usually a kiss of death for an artist.
Right. In other words, though the person in power doesn't get it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, but like you said, it was a little bit Mercy Me kind of beat going on there.
Mercy Beat. It's actually called the Mercy Beat, you know, it's from England originally.
Yep.
And all the black artists fell into it as it was on its way out from England, you know. It was on its way out. It was amazing that all the people that did catch it, though, all the major people, Curtis Mayfield all the way down to Marvin Gaye, all the way up to Marvin Gaye, let's put it that way. Now, everybody that I can remember hit the Mercy Beat when it was big.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah.
From a phrasing standpoint, you hear a lot of that in his daughter, Layla. And that's why she's such a, she is a supremely talented singer, and she understands music well. So it's no surprise that she and Rachel Farrell are kind
Rochelle
of like kindred,
Farrell.
Rochelle
Farrell
are kindred spirits like that, because they're both really superior talents in that they understand the music they're singing.
Yeah. No, I mean, Layla Hathaway is pretty much in that soul jazz slant. She is pretty much the top person in the business right now. Like, she's winning Academy Awards and such. I mean, when she puts out a live album, like in dedication to her father, I mean, it's as good as anything from back in the day.
David, you turned me on to her. You turned me on to her. I mean, she was already happening and stuff, but I didn't really stop and listen to Mr. Hathaway's daughter. And she is fantastic.
Yeah, no, it's really good stuff. All right, well, we've got an interesting version of a track that we're familiar with, Women of the Ghetto, which I think you remember the Marlena Shaw. But
yes, I do.
Here is Doris Duke's version.
Damn.
Now you may have seen
Doris Duke here on African Rhythms. Woman of the Ghetto. 101.9 FM, CITR. I've got my special guests, Jason Hoover and Mike. Once again, you check out our podcast for our last show that we did together just a couple weeks ago. But we've got next, we're going to go Belloid and great lesser name that got overlooked. We'll do a little 20th century spotlight.
You played this a while ago, and I hadn't heard it in a long time, but it was awesome track. And I like this key.
Yeah, this is something special.
Well, I haven't heard it, so I'm ready.
Get into your
And that is the Southside Movement. And that's our little 20th century record spotlight. Two tracks that are majorly good, but got majorly overlooked.
No kidding. A lot of talent there, my brother. You said Chuck Davis produced that first Beloit track. 20th Century Records had Chuck Davis, Gene Page, and Barry White all working for them at the same time there. So they were turning out some quality product. And that
master
definitely
producer.
Yes, and that sounds like a disco track only because of the tempo and stuff. But, I mean, the voice, the vocals, everything in that, that's a solid track.
Yes, the Southside Movement, it's getting into that 77 disco hustle kind of period.
Mm-hmm. But I think they're coming out of it. I mean, I think they've been there just by hearing what I heard. They've been there. They're trying to stretch it out to something else that's theirs. Mm-hmm.
You know? That's what you like about some guys to do with disco is they tried to get more adventurous, but sometimes the A&Rs just didn't get it, like you're saying.
Because you're arguing with the producers. The producers become the stars instead of the music. Mm-hmm. And the disco era, pardon me, that was what they were trying to do. They were taking away from the artist by creating the producing and that production madness ended up with a lot of schlocky stuff, but every now and then you had something that was quality. And
I mean, some good tracks would get picked, but so much would get overlooked. I mean, you would have guys like the Paradise Garage or the Loft and the kind of things they were picking, although most of it really only got known within 5 or 10 years of them doing it as opposed to right away.
Yeah.
Because back in those pre-internet days, it was maybe just a little bit harder to get playlists or mixtapes of, say, radio from New York. I mean, I would occasionally get something like that. Or I'd get tapes. My cousin would tape me from Soul Radio in England. And, you know, those ways of accessing. But it was different then than it is now, you know, whereas everything's online now.
Yeah, this is where we have to give credit to the Northern Soul movement, because there's an old 100-proof aged in soul track called One Man's Leftovers is Another Man's Meat. And the Northern Soul folks were responsible for making sure that all of these folks that were discarded. I mean, that Beloit track's a perfect example of that, because it sounded commercial. And I don't mean in a bad way. It was like, this is something that, should have been hot airplay.
Yeah.
But over in the UK, they understand music better. You know, this is, to a lesser degree, this is no different than the bebop stuff. They made sure that these cats were appreciated and they enjoyed their music. And they made a whole movement out of this simply because of their love of the music.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's incredible how some of these tracks get discovered and how later you know, it's such a revelation. Like the next track that we're going to listen to, Brazilian Rhyme, Earth, Wind, and Fire. I mean, I rocked that track many times, just that, what is it, 2 minutes
the
long?
Hook, yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, just at the end of their album. But who was to know there was actually an original studio full track that they made? So tonight, my friend Michael Ingram and Jason Hoover, we get to hear it. It's the full Brazilian Rhyme.
Yeah.
And that is Tom Brown.
Writer.
listening to African Rhythms with David Love Jones, Michael Ingham, and our special guest, Mr. Jason Hoover.
And welcome back. And Jason, can you hear us now?
Oh, I'm fine. I've always been fine.
All right. Okay, well, let's just go over what we heard. We were listening to some very special gospel funk from, I guess, probably around the late 70s. No, and that's called Heavenly Places.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty special.
That's like the early days of Gospel House, because it's a short track, but you can see where the producer would have remixed that into a real nice groove.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a good observation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. Mike, I'm telling you, that is what I was thinking. I was saying, what's wrong with this? What does it need, you know? Mm-hmm. And this needs to be reworked and, mm-hmm. brought up into today's world with the technology that we have in recording. This mm-hmm. is old stuff.
Mm-hmm. And then Tom Brown, there's a slightly lesser known track from Tom Brown, the man that did Funkin' for Jamaica mm-hmm. and Brighter Tomorrow.
Well, Funkin' in Jamaica was a hit. That was his only hit.
You know, it wasn't his only hit.
You
know, it was the one that got the major play. But Tom Brown really
Come for a Ride.
Come for a Ride, Thighs High to the Sky. There was a lot of good stuff, because I think Magic had three or four really great tracks, that album Magic that he had. This is an earlier one that he did, Rock and Radio. So,
Yeah, that's definitely a lesser-known one, but it shows you that he had some staying power, because mm-hmm. he put out at least four or five albums. So, that was a reasonable run he had there.
For
a jazz funk artist, I wouldn't say that's that easy, really.
No, it's not. And that goes back to what we were saying about that whole era, jazz fusion, all that stuff was going on. The producers are trying to kill this with disco. And it's like, real music always stands the test of time.
It does.
So, it's all about how we get exposed to it.
Yeah.
I think Jason was a perfect example when we were talking in the car about how you were saying you didn't hear James Brown until a lot later because of where you were.
So you came from Edmonton.
Yeah. Okay, you can ban me at that, but I'm saying you could go to Calgary, you could go to Winnipeg, you could go as far as Thunder Bay before you hit Toronto and all the things in Montreal, all playing,
rock.
Tom Brown, playing all the things that we didn't hear it in.
I remember in Calgary when I worked in a record store in 79, 80, 81, the stuff that was getting, more like 79, 80. But I was in Calgary then, and I remember the black folks were coming in and asking for Tom Brown.
Mm-hmm.
That was big. Gap Band, even Curtis Blow.
I didn't even think about that, but that's an interesting perspective, because you have a record store, and then you, of course, to some degree, you got to keep, in step with what people are listening to and whatnot. Mm. So it would be an epicenter.
Yeah.
You had more stuff than the radio stations did, because when I got here, the radio stations were terrible.
Yeah.
Which is one reason why CITR and Co-op and all of those meant so much. I mean, Seattle had the best station in the area, unfortunately.
I find that you're right, totally right, Mike. But, I was spoiled with listening to, I guess, what was the station at that time? It was the Call Letters in Seattle, and it was... We listened to that. We didn't listen to any of our stuff up here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. I bet there was some good radio out of Seattle. Mm-hmm. That's
man. Oh, I was getting I used to go down to Seattle just to buy the records of stuff I wasn't hearing. Mm-hmm. And when I finally started to hear it, my pocketbook became a little more, money. Yeah, a little more money, and it was nice to be able to buy anything I wanted in Seattle. My friend Donnie Girard, who was with Skylark, and he had his own record.
He was in the Trials of Jason Hoover.
No, it was Skylark. He was with me in the Trials. Yes,
yeah,
he was.
Yeah, he was in the Trials. Of the incantations.
He went down to South. He went down South, and he had a girlfriend down there in Los Angeles, and he bumped into B.J. Cook, and she... got him to come with Skylark.
Right. That happened after Trials of Jason Hoover. Yeah. Well, let's get back to your... what we wanted to focus on a little bit was one of the final things that happens with the original Epics was you playing on the CBC and hosting the whole show, which they filmed.
That was a privilege, David, and it was a good privilege because nobody else did that. Nobody else was shot to do the show by themselves. I was the only one picked.
But did you get a phone call? Or
I was doing that show, Let's Go, and whatever else they called it. I was doing like I was paying my mortgage, man, on it. Yeah. You know, I was...
Yeah, you'd done previous shows where you'd done cover versions and you were on just part of the show, or maybe you did two numbers on the show. And then that went on for a little while.
That went on for quite a while. That was
about 3 years, I guess. Yeah. And then eventually opportunity came knocking, but it was... Jimi Hendrix, which is one of the striking moments of what you did on that 1968 show, you performed The Wind Cries Mary, and Jimmy Harmata takes the guitar solo.
Jimmy Harmata played the shit out of that, didn't he?
Yeah, no, that was good.
I think he played really wonderful. I was so proud of him, you know, because we didn't have rehearsal time, and we had in those days there was a time limit for the show. There was it was like you couldn't waste a minute. Everything had to be like that. There was no repeat, so we had to be well rehearsed before we came to the show.
You know? you did all that live mostly.
Everything was live.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Well, let's check it out now. Yeah. 1968, Jason Hoover and one of the top groups, R&B groups, in the 60s in Vancouver, in the incredible R&B scene. And here it is, The Wind Cries Mary, an historic moment in local black history.
But tonight we're going to bring you the top three blues tunes in Vancouver. But tonight we're going to bring you the top three blues tunes in Vancouver. But tonight we're going to bring you... But tonight we're going to bring you the top three blues tunes in Vancouver. But after all the jacks are in their boxes, and the clouds have all gone to bed, you can see happiness standing on downstream. Footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers Mary. A broom is thoroughly sweeping of the pieces of yesterday. Somewhere a queen is weak, somewhere king has no one, and the wind cries Mary. It turned blue tomorrow, sat in emptiness down on my bed. The tiny island sat on downstream. This life that lived is dead, and the wind cried Mary. Will the wind ever remember all the names it has called in the past? With this club, this old age that has wisdom, the wisdom knows this would be the last. And the wind, it screams, Mary.
And that right now, is an incredible local moment. Jason Hoover and the Epics, live at the CBC.
Wow, David, I don't know where you get all this.
Thanks to Rob. Rob from Neptune is the major archivist of Jason Hoover's history when it comes to posters and even material. He's even got unreleased stuff by you.
I know, yeah. But he's also controls a lot of my music, too. You didn't know he owns it now, do you? He owns, yes.
Well, no, we're talking about Rob from Neptune.
Yes, Rob from Neptune.
Yeah, but he doesn't own your music.
Owns some Jack and Jill, and that was a publishing company. Music, and a lot of it is Jason Hoover.
Crazy.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something? Yeah. I'm waiting for him to put out Jason
Hoover.
No
wonder he wants me to do the film.
Yeah, right. I'm waiting to put out the golden, yeah.
Well, you know,
well, we're about to find out all that.
Yes,
anyway.
But just on the track alone is magnificent. I ain't just saying that because we buddies now. I mean, nobody does Hendrix. You know, we had Robin Trower and others trying the musical instrumental aspects of it, but there's only like 5 or 6 Hendrix songs that you can actually sing.
Yeah, that's true.
And nobody else would try something like that. Your phrasing was on point. It was as if I was listening to Jimmy, no joke.
Yeah,
and it's indicative of what you obviously were influenced by, because you had Jimmy, you had Sly. You know, and we heard one song from the last show that sounded like an old Sly track, so here you go, the vocals and whatnot, and it's on point, and it's live one time, you know.
But the funny part, Mike, is they were all here, man. I mean, Sly Stone was up here playing every weekend. UBT, Simon Fraser. I mean, it was only a hop, skip, and a jump.
They weren't getting played on the radio.
That's the difference.
Exactly. So nobody really knew what was coming. And the fact that this stuff is going on and this stuff is being played is indicative of something bigger here we're talking about.
That's true.
No, but having said all of that, I want to get into the whole issue of the show, because, you know, back in the day, we all grew up. I mean, at least I grew up in the States. I was listening to Shindig and Hullabaloo and all this stuff.
I did too.
And, you know, when the artists were coming on, you know, it was assumed, and I don't like assuming, but it was assumed that the artists were going to get paid to do original stuff. I mean, American Bandstand or Shindig comes on, Leslie Gore is going to come on singing "It's My Party and I Cry If I Want To." She's getting paid because of that. You know, so original material made all the difference in the world. So that's why I was asking, what happened regarding the music people up here? Why were they so adamant about you not singing original material?
It really is a complicated situation, being the only black singer in basically radio at that time, because I was one of the only recording artists. I mean, Little Daddy and the Bat Show, yes, they had, you know, No Monkey Business, that was there, but I had a multitude of songs. I was very fortunate to be picked to do this, Mike. I mean, I was like beside myself that they would let me have so much time at CBC, that they would let me have so much time on the radio station, FM stations, LG FM, and C-Fun FM.
Right.
I mean, I was spoiled because I was the only one, so they only had me to pick from, so it was great. It was great.
Well, CBC's national. So that's where I have to ask the question, after you did this, what happened to Jason Hoover? You would have thought that would have raised enough attention for everybody to understand he is a homegrown talent. He's got all this good stuff right here in front of you. How come you didn't promote him?
I was just very happy to be on a show. I was never into making myself something that I really wasn't. I wanted to be me and be exposed as me. So any time I got to do my tune or my own picks of the songs I was going to do on TV, I was joyful. I was so happy, you know. It's awful when they squeeze the death out of you and make you do things that aren't really you.
Yeah.
And we had the top 5 on CBC show, and we had to do the top 5 tunes of that day.
Right. So, I mean, really, it was hard for you. I mean, you only just started to get heard when changed to the name The Trials of Jason Hoover. I mean, until then, it was all covers, you know. Finally, one of your songs gets out. But then with The Trials, I mean, it wasn't... Why was there no Epics album? I mean, if there had been an Epics album, there would have been some original.
Exactly,
material.
Exactly.
The Epics
and
broke up.
King Size would have been one of the songs.
For the Epics, yes.
Yeah.
But King Size was big across Canada and all the top cities, like not the towns and stuff, mm-hmm. that had radio stations. It was like, it would be Edmonton playing, CHED was number one, Edmonton, Calgary, mm-hmm. CKXL
yep.
was the big station there, and they were playing it, and all the way across Canada, okay?
Yeah.
Just the sister stations of all the stations I'm telling you about mm-hmm. were playing it. Other places, no. They yeah. weren't into it.
But getting back to the 68 TV show.
Yeah.
So another track you did was George Clinton's first hit. You know, the Parliaments was early days for
Funkadelic
Parliament.
I was down in Seattle every other weekend to pick up my records that they didn't have up here. And that's yeah. why I got all that stuff when you heard me. Friends, can't be friends. That was me. You know?
Yeah.
I didn't mm-hmm. copy his style
mm-hmm. yeah.
of the tune. If you listen to George Clinton's tune, it's double funk, you know.
Yeah, yep.
The Parliaments, the Funkadelics, mm-hmm. all.
Yeah, but I mean, the early days, he was a bit more like Motown cover because he was from Detroit.
Well, I didn't hear mm-hmm. much of his stuff.
Yeah.
Well, Testify was a bit more in the Motown like.
Testify was the one I really
yeah.
loved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really till later that he did the more funk and rock funk mm-hmm. and whatever
yeah.
have you.
When he became the Parliaments, and I didn't know him as a Parliament. It was just, you know,
yeah.
the Funkadelics is as far as I got with him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to do Testify then, I mean, again, this is major local history. Here is Jason Hoover on National Canadian TV doing George Clinton. I mean, how does it get any cooler
didn't even
than that?
Know who exactly. George Clinton was. That's the funny part.
Yeah, yeah, no one knew who George Clinton was. But okay, listeners, I think we're going to have to drop this for you now.
All right.
Hi. I hope you like soul music, because that's what we're presenting today on Let's Go. I'm Jason Hoover. These are the Ethics.
Incredible. We're talking live in Vancouver in 1968, nationally broadcast TV show. George Clinton, Jason Hoover, and the Epics.
That we were unique. They loved it all the way from, I guess Montreal, all the way back to Vancouver, Victoria, man. It was anything. It was like we were starved for anything that was going to be for sure. Everybody in Canada wanted for sure.
Well, I guess the CBC folk liked your funky version of that. I mean, if they didn't know George Clinton.
They paid for my home, and I mean, I was on the show for 3 years. They paid the mortgage.
Well, I'll tell you this much. I bet you guys heard it before we did, Because in New York, you know, you had that locked thing. If you weren't recording for Columbia, Epic,
yep.
or Atlantic Records, they weren't going to play you on regular radio. We heard that song on WWRL, which was the soul station, maybe about 2 months or so after
it was
that
hit.
Thing came out. Exactly. You know, so it was all after the fact. And, you know, I'm not surprised you heard it. I'm just surprised that there wasn't a Jason Hoover and the Epics album after the fact. So what happened with you and the band
it
after
was,
the show?
It wasn't anything
it
to
was
do the with
end
the band.
Almost
we were
going
to do
Epics.
This album. Actually, yeah. we recorded in enough songs to have an album.
Right.
It was about the money. It was about, well, you know, you guys had a good song, but it wasn't a big hit. We can't put out this money unless it was a big hit.
For
that's
real?
The way they thought. That's the way they thought. That's why Jason Hoover never had an album after many, and Dave will tell you how many 45s I recorded.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, at least there was this pretty underground and only locally released, and I believe only 100 copies were pressed. Mm-hmm. But the Live at the Grooveyard did manage to get 3 Epics, supposedly live at the Grooveyard, but actually live in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So 3
too.
Studio tracks were recorded of covers for that album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For Live at the Grooveyard, we were right in the studio, but we tried with the doors open, things off the door, to make it live. You know? We wanted to make it, so we pulled down the things with holes in it, moved the things, you know, to make it as live as possible out of a studio.
Mm-hmm.
Even had the door open a couple of times just to get that on the clapping, you know, the, we had false clapping, just to get that echoey, you know.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But
you know,
it was only a local hit, though, strangely, the Live at the Grooveyard, because it was only
locally
pressed.
There was a whole
bunch
of groups that did that. We're all knowing that
Soul
album.
Unlimited.
There was 4
albums. Night Train
that,
Review.
Yeah. Kenter Steel and the Chantels.
Kenter Steel and the Chantels. And there was some Garage Box band
so many,
there, too.
The,
yeah, Nocturnals.
All, like,
the Nocturnals were in there.
Same playing the same places I was playing. They were rivals, and we didn't even, we thought everything they did was sucked, you know, everybody, you know, we thought we were the only ones that were doing it.
You know, let me ask you, how many other vocalists were like the house singers during that Ready Go series? Because it was you, and obviously they had to have others to sing certain types of songs.
I had tunes out on Live at the Grooveyard, which really actually put me in CBC,
okay?
He heard all this, and he wanted that. He wanted me and my group on it. So he got invested. We did shows every 2 or 3 weeks. Then eventually I became a household name right across Canada, which I really appreciated. And I started to do shows. And then he said, listen, I got a great idea. This is Ken Gibson, the producer of Let's Go Vancouver. He says, Jason, you're just too special. I mean, I see all the shows from across Canada, and you're just outstanding. You're outstanding, and you know we've got to do more for you. You're gonna have your own show.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like not thought of, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow. He says, what I'd like for you to do is pick the songs you'd like to sing, and give me all the songs that you think are possible things. Mm-hmm. So you put both of them together and give them to me, and I'd like to pick out the song.
How old were you then?
23.
Mm-hmm.
23 for sure. And I did it until I was 30 with CBC. They love me.
So how did the business, how had you been with the business up to that point? Had you been burned up to the show?
I had been doing the show even before Ken Gibson finally cornered the production end.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing it before Ken was actually named as the producer for it. And it wasn't called Let's Go then. It was called something else. I forget. It's on the tip of my tongue.
Mm-hmm.
But I did a couple of those shows. And then after there were letters, there were phone calls to the CBC after the shows were played, and that swayed them. Because a lot of them were saying, we'd like to see that guy, that colored guy that was on the show.
They had a lot of, there was a lot of white guys doing Pat Boone type impersonations
too. Many,
too. So.
Too many people liked my trip. Too many people liked my trip. And then eventually he says, listen, we're going to give you a show. You know, it's not because we think that you've earned it.
Mm-hmm.
And from the letters and phone calls and all the feedback, you're number one across Canada. They want you to, you know.
So that's my point. You were getting positive feedback across country from everybody saying, we like this guy. We want to hear more of this guy.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Okay.
And that's how it worked for us. And I was very, very pleased. And I realized that I was taking things very seriously now, and I was really serious about my career.
Mm-hmm.
And after the exposure across Canada a few times, it was really easy. And it set up big dates for us, you know, to play across Canada a couple of times. Well, actually, I played across Canada 4 times. from Halifax back here to Victoria.
Mm-hmm. And what so you opened for
coming back.
Mm-hmm. You opened for Wilson Pickett's a few months before you did the Let's Go whole show, right?
Exactly. We did. We opened for him, but I opened for Solomon Burke as well. Mm-hmm. I opened for a few acts that people never even thought of. I opened for Otis Redding.
Right.
In Victoria.
Wow. In Victoria.
Okay.
Victoria. I didn't see the show because what he did is he had everybody that was be any kind of interference move to the green room.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear. I heard it, but I didn't see it. He didn't want any interference, man.
Wow.
And he didn't play Vancouver. He only played Victoria, man.
Well, I mean, another track from this 1968 show is your version of Funky Broadway, which I think is a pretty badass funky track. You might not think it's as good as the great Pickett, but I mean, come on, that's a pretty high standard. I mean, okay, the Pickett is one of the most mind-blowing people ever in soul music.
Yeah.
So I think you're being too hard on yourself. Now, let's the listeners hear your version of Funky Broadway and let them decide for themselves how good this is. This is local funk. Here in Vancouver on a nationally broadcast show, Jason Hoover and the Epics doing Funky Broadway.
But tonight we're going to bring you the top.
And that was Funky Broadway live here in Vancouver. A bit more like the raw funk version of the original Dyke and the Blazers, Mike and I were noticing.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the way he came down on Name of, that's Dyke's version. That's Wilson did his own, Stacks. But I like Dyke's. Dyke's was grittier.
All right, well, Stack's version was about anything. Anything to do with the war between Motown and Stack's artists. Stacks always won, man. Because that was soul. They were the soul to the soul.
The raw funk.
Commercial soul with David Ruffin. I love that, but it can only be heard so long. I mean, I didn't do very many David Ruffin songs because after you did it twice in the week that we were playing at a certain club, it was time to go into something else, you know? There's only one David Ruffin.
No, I mean, that's that Funky Broadway. That was a hell of a groove, you know, for a local track, Rock Across Canada.
Wilson Pickett was well known here. He played up in Canada at the Gardens, all the places that they had on that area. The Gardens.
Did you get to meet him when you opened them?
All the places he played. It seems like he was up here every 6 months.
Did you get to meet him?
Did I get to meet him? Yeah. I told you. Oops. Yeah. I opened for him, man.
Yeah.
And
I know.
Was in the same green room.
I know.
He paced. I was relaxed. That was so funny. He was nervous to go on a show with white people only. And it was packed. It was packed for Wilson. He was so happy.
Yeah. No, he was having a pretty big impact. All right. Well, we should mention tonight some sad news about Bobby Taylor, that he's having some quite serious surgery. We wish him all the best. We want to send some good vibes to Bobby Taylor.
God bless him. He's definitely Canada's far, far removed from the ordinary crowd singer. He was unique. Yeah. He was fantastic. Not too many people could phrase like Bobby.
Yeah.
Bobby probably could have, when he was offered the job after David Ruffin left, to be the Temptations lead singer, which I'm so happy that he didn't grab because it shocked.
He could have probably been in the Temptations. Look how well he could do Marvin.
Oh, yeah. He did all those songs so well. But I'm saying they did offer it to him. And he told Barry, he said, look, how much money have we spent on Bobby Taylor and the Vancouver's? And we are now trying to break away from that so I can have my name.
I feel bad for Bobby that, you know, he's been away in Hong Kong and we haven't got to appreciate him in recent years. I mean, I did get to interview him and went down to when he was playing locally, but he wasn't really appreciated enough locally. I mean,
That's
I remember
what happens
talking to the media
when you become the local boy, you know, I can attest to that. When you are just great and people say, he's great. He's wonderful. Meantime, you're a local boy.
Rossini's didn't pay so well.
Don't mix. No, it doesn't.
You know, Rossini's was giving him like $100, something like that. You know, I mean, you got Bobby Taylor, friggin', you know, one of the most incredible performers.
We do four songs. I get $100. Bobby, same thing, man.
He did a lot more than four songs.
It was his set.
He had Red Robinson opening for him and whatever.
I was there, man. I saw the show. I wasn't on the show, but I was there for that. And
Bobby, he told me to come down. Like, when he found out that I was really into soul music, he was really happy that there was a local guy like me. So he really encouraged me to come down. And I didn't make it down one night. And he came by the shop. He's like, look, you're coming down, right? And I was like, okay,
This brings us back to the issue at hand, though. You got local talent, Canadian talent. You know, you should be appreciating
that. Major.
Exactly. I mean, even in New York, as bad as New York was for finding talent and promoting talent, we still had New York bands that got some promotion before they went somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about people who are doing stuff that everybody heard, everybody did, everybody liked. So it's not like we're asking for favor here. It's just that whatever the apparatus was, whoever these gatekeepers were responsible for hindering this whole process.
They did
Bobby got his back to a degree by getting signed to Motown, but then he got even worse exploited by them. You know, so, I mean, being part of the corporation didn't really do him any favors.
No.
He tried to get his lawyers at one point to sue them over that, but he just didn't have the power and the money to really do it, you know. So he lost that case, according to what he said.
The only person that ever won a case against my man, who was controlling O-Town, was David Ruffin.
Right. Well, Stevie had his way with him.
Oh, Stevie. He spoiled Stevie, man. Yeah. I mean, Stevie didn't have to go to court. I mean, talking about
I guess
David
Stevie
Ruffin
made enough money that he was able to dictate the terms.
Exactly. And Stevie made a lot more money because of Marvin. Because if Marvin had not released What's Going On, it would have shut down Stevie's creative flow.
There would never been InnerVisions.
It wouldn't have been InnerVisions, exactly.
Yeah.
Talking about all of that other stuff, you couldn't credit anything. Marvin made the difference with everybody.
Marvin was the greatest of all times, as far as I'm concerned, for any Motown artist. He had things that other people didn't have. And I'm talking about things that I know about singers. And again, I'll mention again, it's phrasing. Is such and so important and how you make a song feel.
Well, getting back to here is somebody that is an incredible songsmith and phrasing, and that is Sending Love out to Hong Kong tonight to our good friend Bobby Taylor. We're hoping he can make it through this surgery.
It's
so
fantastic.
Here is from his second Motown album, Little Miss Sweetness.
Yeah, that's a great tune too, as well.
Sweet things I adore. before. Your kiss was sweeter than any cup of coffee I ever made before. To know your little miss
sweetness,
your little miss
sweetness,
sweetest girl in the world now,
sweetest girl in the world now.
If ever a man had a sweet tooth, I have one indeed. I ordered cookies and cakes and malts and shakes from the menus that I read. But all the shakes and cakes and malts I have brought put together don't exceed the sweetness and just one of your kisses. Baby, you're the one I need. You know you're little miss
sweetness.
That is The Masqueraders, and that's a song, Mike, that we never got to play back in some of the old shows, because again, kind of an unknown.
It was. You know, the Masqueraders didn't do a lot of up-tempo stuff. You know, they were kind of like the Delphonics in that aspect. You know, they'd hear, you did those soulful gut ballads and stuff, but this was totally different. That's up-tempo. Sounds Northern Soul to me, frankly.
Yeah, exactly. That's Northern Soul. Mm-hmm. And basically, whoever was uncovering copies of that wasn't sharing.
Yeah, nice try.
So, it, you know, I mean, I think that with Northern Soul, some of it's about secrets and exclusivity. Mm-hmm. So, sadly, sometimes that doesn't actually help the exposure to the music.
That's true. But, you know, at least it's getting played. And I know there had to be more than a couple of people whose careers were revived simply because the Northern Soul folks embraced them, you know, and gave them
without
an opportunity.
A doubt. Yeah.
They left me alone. I tried to get next to them, but they were, well, get back to us next week or next month, whenever you're back on tour, man. Mm-hmm. Never happened. But some 90 good things did happen, though. Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, so. Well, I mean, when you're... When the Epics, Kari McClelland and your son reformed the Epics, I think that, and I got to DJ it, I think that the platform at that time was kind of marketing your sound as Northern Soul. You know, like they were trying to bring it back that way.
I heard about that so many times during that period of time. I was going through a slight depression during that time. So I didn't pay much music attention to anything that was said about me.
No, I remember at the time I wanted to meet you and I was talking to Christine and I was talking to your son and they're like, no problem, we'll make a connection for you. I was like, I want to get him on my show.
Yeah.
And they're like, no problem, we'll make it happen. And I couldn't understand why you weren't there, you know, or why at least you weren't singing part of the vocals.
No, I wouldn't step on my son's cloud. He needed a space to expand himself.
Yeah.
And not to be compared to me. I wanted him to sing everything the way he felt it, not the way he heard it. I wanted him to, I just over and over, I kick his butt and say, listen, forget about the way you practiced it. Just go out there and sing it the way you feel it. And when he started to do it, they ended it.
Well, then let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. You just did a Hendrix cover.
Oh, yeah.
You did a George Clinton cover. Mm-hmm. And you did a Dyke
and the
slash Wilson Pickett cover.
Yeah.
Now, all of this was in your comfort zone. What does your original music sound more like?
Definitely Stax sound. If you could hear all the tapes I have at home, and maybe someday you'll be able to, mm-hmm. my rehearsals, my picking songs that we would practice that we hoped we were going to use, was all Stax like. We stayed away from Bobby Taylor and Motown as much as we possibly could. Mm-hmm.
That was smart.
Yeah, that was smart.
Because we didn't get a real full shot of Stax and what they were about. We knew Cropper and Duck Dunn and all that stuff.
Yep.
We knew that they were Jackson, you know, Booker T. The thing about Booker T. Jackson is that I guess it took me about 3 years to realize that the Booker T was black.
Was what?
No, all we heard about was Cropper and Duck Dunn and the drummer. We knew the drummer was black. We knew that. And there was nobody could drum like that guy, you know. With little effort. I mean, it was just
man, he was pretty fantastic. Good crossover action, though, for sure.
It was definitely some good crossover action. Yeah. Booker T. Jones was definitely a brother. But the groove they laid down, definitely, I can feel... That was something you were more at home with, but I had to ask that for clarification.
Well, you did a good job. No, I was Stax all the way, man. I thought Motown, which I loved, was too smooth for me. My voice was.
But they were designed to clean it up. That was their intent.
My phrasing.
Although that's what you did in the earlier days of the covers on "Let's Go" or Motown.
Oh, yeah. I had to. They didn't know much about Stax and those. It was Motown that was handling it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I opened for Stevie Wonder. I opened for, what was that girl? To serve with
Lulu.
Love.
Lulu. Yeah, Lulu.
I forget her name,
Lulu.
But she was a great.
She was big at the
her
time.
Name was Lulu.
She was a great partier. That's all right. Yeah. She was a great partier. I really loved her. We had an after-hour show at the Vancouver Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And she was fantastic.
All right. Well, listen, we're going to wrap up this African Rhythms. And we're going to go out with another Northern Soul track.
Yes!
Nothing but Heartaches, the Flirtations.
They actually played this on WABC. This must have been a huge seller because they played this almost immediately.
And this truly did become a Northern Soul anthem.
Yeah.
All right. Well, take it out, Mike.
Well, for everybody out there, Canada Day, please, play nice, go safe. We want you to get from A to B and back to A, okay? And always remember that if you want to know where the soul trees go, the roots can there be found go. Right here on African Rhythms.
Peace everybody here is love. Qualified, especially my man over here from Philly.
All right. Well, thanks again, Jason.
Thank you. Yeah, well, hey, man, I'm just so happy to do your show. You know that. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have you back. And coming up at the top of the hour, Spoken Word Radio in Skulls Hall.
Oh, that sounds good. Well, that was a good show, guys. It was a good show. It's rusty and rugged.
Show de Leo Ramírez, lunes 4 a 5 de la tarde en el 101.9 FM, CITR. The Leo Ramírez Show, Monday 4 to 5 p.m. at 101.9 FM, CITR.